if you think you can touch or, you know, save one life out there and you do it, like, it's all worth it. And if someone isn't expressing what you have, like you're looking for support or help with something or a specific topic, and that voice isn't there, become that voice.
What's going on, guys? Anand here, and you are tuning into the podcast where I get to spend time, remotely at least, with people whose life journey has taken them across borders, and as a result has inspired positive growth, not only in their own life, but those around them. And with the help of each of you listening, these memories, experiences, and lessons learned get to journey onwards as well. If you listened to last week's episode, and if you haven't, then I may need you to pause and really think about why you haven't done so.
Oh, that's a good question.
But assuming that you have, I mentioned at the end that I had some remarkable guest stories lined up in the coming weeks, and I do not plan to disappoint you. My guest today has been in digital marketing for more than 10 years and in podcasting for almost 4. His knowledge and ability to articulate in these areas is second to none. And luckily for you, you don't have to take my word for it. You'll witness it throughout this episode. But what we cover about his life journey stems far deeper and wider than this. Roman Prokopchuk was born in Ukraine in the early 80s, a time when the Soviet Union was still in ruling, which meant that suppression, censorship, and anti-religious movements were still rife.
You know, there's like KGB waiting and kind of keeping a tally, like when people were leaving church, so stuff like that.
And when he was only 5, he left with his family on a sponsored visa to the US, but not before having spent a few weeks in Rome and Vienna along the way. We discuss how arriving with his family into the US with little money and knowing barely any English strengthened his natural hustle mindset, and how he's had that in action and been making money from it ever since he was a young boy in school.
And I'm so pissed, like, thinking back, you know how many Michael Jordan cards I sold back in the day? That if I had those, if they were mint and I got them graded, they would be, like, a considerable amount of money. But yeah.
Since then, he really has been inspiring people in every aspect of his life. From digital marketing and podcasting support, to fostering 25 children and opening up about his own life adversities, in a hope that those who hear it can be inspired by it too. And yes, you heard that right. I did say 25.
And then if you ask me, you know, 2.5 years, you'll have 25 kids come through your home. I'd be like, what are you talking about?
But this is still only scratching the surface of his extraordinary life. Let's just say if he ever writes an autobiography, I will be one of the first to reserve a copy. So now that I have your pupils dilated in anticipation, it's time for you to buckle up and enjoy the journey. So I have to admit, I've been looking forward to this conversation ever since we agreed the date. Not only because of your journey of leaving Ukraine and having to navigate and find your way in a completely contrasting society at such a young age, but ever since then, there's just such a multitude of layers to your life story. So I'm really excited and looking forward to unpacking some of these and to understand them from your own perspective.
Yep, I appreciate you having me on.
And one thing I remember you saying in one of your own episodes was that the way that you deal with some of the negative comments and bullying that you got at school was to remind yourself that even at such a young age, you'd probably already been through more than even the average American adult. And so you really use that to help to not let judgments negatively affect you. I'd love to know what some of these experiences were that you went through, you know, stemming all the way back to when you were in Ukraine and what you remember of that. What were these experiences that you'd had at such a young age?
Yeah, so I left Ukraine. It was still under the Soviet Union. So I came to the U.S. in March. Oh, well, yes, it's an anniversary. So March of 1990, I was born in 84, Ukraine gained its independence in 92. So just seeing kind of certain things, like there was like bread lines, power being shut off at night, or like hot water at night. Obviously, under communism, technically, they don't, you know, observe or view, you know, worshiping or having a religion. So if you did go to church, you know, openly or practice your religion, you would have certain consequences, things being taken away. So my mom, like in high school, was valedictorian. That was taken away from her. If you were like a pastor, for me, you know, I'm a Christian. if you said something that maybe was close to like saying something against the government, you would kind of disappear or be sent to like Siberia to like a labor camp. You know, there's like KGB waiting and kind of keeping a tally like when people were leaving church. So stuff like that. But I guess when you grow up in something like that, it's more normal for you. So whatever your normal is, obviously, if you're coming from maybe a war-torn area or a famine area or something like that, that was your normal. So when you like get thrown into an environment that's a lot more favorable, I think you adapt a lot better per se, and you can deal with things in a different sense because you have that kind of, you know, core of the things that you've experienced and been through.
And you mentioned the point around being sent to Siberia, I guess if you're actively practicing religion, was this something that you went through yourself?
Well, it wasn't like everybody that went to church. It was mainly like the pastors and the leaders. And, you know, if they put thoughts, not thoughts, but if the sermons were a little bit more passionate in the sense that, you know, putting your religion or God or, you know, Jesus Christ, which I think you should, over the state and over the stuff going on in the country or the city. So when it was like getting to a point where it was kind of, they felt maybe like it would cause some kind of insurrection or put certain ideas in people's minds, that's when, you know, people would disappear. I know there were like, outside of religion, there's a lot of famous like poets, writers, songwriters that were Ukrainian that like wrote patriotic songs. And, you know, one of them from the city, I was at, he disappeared and they like gouged out his eyes and hung him, you know, in the street.
Oh, wow.
On a, you know, a tree. He's like, he has this big monument and stuff like that. So it was more so also like if you were patriotic, if you were like pushing, you know, the Ukrainian language, because, you know, under the Soviet Union, all the Soviet Eastern Bloc states that were under it, you know, they made you learn Russian. So like you spoke Russian, but obviously you had your own language or your own dialect as well. So if you were like patriotic or, you know, you didn't fit that mold, like you would probably see problems as well.
Oh, man, that story of his eyes being gouged out, that is that's pretty intense. And so you mentioned your own affinity to religion and Jesus Christ. What was the situation like in your family? Was it something that was actively encouraged or even discouraged to practice a faith or a belief?
Yeah, so I mean, I was born into a Christian household. Later on, you know, when I grew up, I made that choice myself in terms of, you know, having Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior and taking my walk in kind of faith that way. But my grandparents, you know, accepted Christianity. And then my parents were my mom and my dad and their families were kind of born into it. So even from when I remember when I was little, you know, we would be going to church, stuff like that. So that was already kind of ingrained within me. And, you know, we did so, or they did so, openly, regardless of obviously what the consequences were.
Yeah, wow, that really is admirable to stand up for what you believe in, you know, when kind of the whole societal system is working against you. But for what you can remember, in general, what was it like for people that you knew? Did you sense that they were almost scared or fearful to practice their beliefs?
Yeah, I mean, from what I heard from my parents, because like, as you know, I came over when I was young, so when it was 1990, I was 5. But I mean, from the stories that my grandparents and parents told me, yeah, there were people fearful. They were people also fearful in like authority roles. I think some people met privately, like that were afraid to like physically go to a house of worship. So they had like, you know, prayer meetings or like Bible studies or like churches and people's like basements and stuff like that. And I think my mom or my grandmother told me of a situation where they were somewhere and like a police officer knocked, but he was actually Christian. So he was trying to see if like, you know, the people there actually believed in their faith. And then when he saw that, he said, you know, I'm not here to like arrest you or report you. I just wanted to make sure, because he kind of came there to kind of worship himself.
Wow, yeah, that really is amazing. And it really reminds me of a story. Actually, when I interviewed my uncle in season 1, I believe episode 5, and he speaks about how when all the foreigners had to leave East Africa in the 70s because of a government coup, but he tells a story of how there was a local policeman who was really upset to see him and his brothers leave. And it just showed me that sometimes it really is at a high level that these decisions are being made ultimately on behalf of the whole country, and it doesn't often reflect the local citizens and, you know, in this case, the police and their views. So it's interesting to see that that wasn't just a one-off case, and it probably happens in a number of cases around the world. But going back to what you said, it ties in very closely with something that I'm doing as part of season two, which some of the listeners will know, but I do a bi-weekly review of a famous immigrant story. So I did Mila Kunis, and she has a very similar story to you in terms of being born in Ukraine in the 80s, and I believe she left in the same year as you did. Was this quite commonplace that many people were leaving around this time, or had it already been happening for a number of years already?
So it was kind of like the Berlin Wall fell, and then there was like that kind of perestroika movement, so they lessened up tensions and started letting people out. So there was like a mass migration out. Obviously, you couldn't just leave if you wanted to leave. You needed to, you know, have the proper papers and apply. So we applied for a visa, and, you know, being brought over, we had a distant family member that was a sponsor. So at that time, you needed a sponsor, basically a person that was responsible for you and taking on kind of, I guess, the risk, if you will, in terms of, you know, finance and just taking care of you until you kind of got on your feet. So we had someone that was a distant family member, you know, even though they did that, you know, we still came, and everybody in terms of adults got on their feet. You know, we had a 2-bedroom apartment for 6 people. I didn't see that like being tough or anything. I mean, I guess in the U.S., based on, you know, a first world kind of environment, people would seem that's kind of crammed. But, you know, to me, I'm kind of used to that. So it was just that time period, like government wise, the Soviet Union started falling slowly. You know, following years, the former Soviet bloc countries started, you know, gaining their independence or declaring their independence. And that was one of the times in 1990 where there was kind of like a mass, like I said, exodus, if you will. Me and a lot of people, like the way to get to the U.S., we had to go through Vienna, Austria, and then Rome, Italy, and then here.
Oh, wow. And how well do you remember that period? So, you know, the days leading up and actually leaving, did you know that you were ultimately leaving the only thing you'd ever known as home and possibly never returning back?
To a certain extent, I guess with my age, I mean, it was kind of fun for me because we're like going on a trip. Obviously, it was a little bit more stressful for my grandparents' parents and my aunt. And it was one of those things where like the Soviet Union would only let you take what you could take.
So, right,
like, right. If you had property, you had to give ownership to somebody else or the government would take it. It was basically whatever you can carry out, that's all you came with. So like your suitcases and the clothes on your back and basically kind of starting over. And from Austria, Vienna, we went to Rome. Rome, we were there for about 2 months. And actually, the Italian government gave us the option to, you know, legally settle there and, you know, start that and be in Italy permanently. So sometimes I think about, like, the variables in my life or how I would have turned out if we became, you know, Italian citizens and ended up staying in Italy, you know, and not coming over to the United States.
It's an interesting point that you mentioned, because one thing that I also know about you is that you weren't always going to end up where you did in the US. If I'm not mistaken, you could have ended up on the almost the other coast.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? And so I'm wondering, how much do you think the destination where an immigrant ends up affects how they become? And I'm talking more internally. So obviously, you know, where they end up, their accent and their tastes and maybe style will be molded by the environment. But how much do you think that destination impacts the character of a person?
I think a lot. Like you said, I was supposed to technically end up in San Mateo, California, and we ended up in New Jersey, which is literally the opposite coast, you know, thousands of miles away. I actually have family members in California, so I know how they turned out in terms of kind of their demeanor, their personality, like their character and stuff like that. So I think if the variables did change, like I guarantee you I would have different hobbies. I'd probably be like, you know, like skateboarding or surfing or see myself in that way. Obviously a certain set of friends. So I think it's wherever you're thrown into, obviously you have that background from where you're coming from. But then the variables that you're presented mold you even further. So it's like, you know, you're this person and you're made to this point, and then you get thrown into this environment with these variables and then they, you know, build on you from there. But I think like that drive and, you know, knowing who I am and having that grit and kind of that immigrant kind of chip on your shoulder to, I guess, prove everybody that you can do something, I think that still would have, you know, resonated and been there.
Yeah, I'm really glad at the point you just made then. And I agree with everything you've said. And it reminds me of when I was investigating my own family journey through season one and learning how they, similar to you, could only leave with what they could carry, essentially. So that was, you know, one suitcase, and they even had a limit on the amount of money they could take out. And so that idea of, you know, that grit and that chip on the shoulder, I think I agree that whatever situation you're thrown into, in that, in one way, it doesn't matter the destination, that side of you always gets carried wherever you go. And so just before we move on to the next chapter of your life, something else that I learned from the review I did of Mila Kunis, she spoke about when her grandfather came to the US for the first time and the stark differences that she realized in terms of the way of life, you know, the idea of there being a Disney World, which is ultimately a place that you pay to go and have fun. And she said, you know, that kind of thing just didn't exist in Ukraine when she was there. Do you think that there are people who still experience this kind of stark difference in the way of life compared to what we're used to in, you know, the more developed world?
Yeah, and it's what you're kind of, you have access to and what you see. So, you know, in terms of like where I came to in the United States, there's people from like hundreds of countries. So like growing up and knowing different cultures to begin with, I think one, you're like more tolerant of, you know, people's traditions and views and culture and stuff like that. But when you're kind of in like an echo chamber, when something new is presented, you treat it a little bit differently. So like the mindset's different. So like here, I take every opportunity, and if, you know, I fail at it, it's never really a failure. It's a learning experience. Mm. Somebody on my show said, everything in life is a lesson or a blessing. So like, I take it like that. But I think like an Eastern European mindset, it's somewhat coming from communism, it's very pessimistic. So they don't trust anybody. Obviously, Ukraine has one of the most corrupt government systems still. So you have to, like, in terms of entrepreneurship, it's hard to be an entrepreneur because you can get shut down if somebody doesn't like you and pays off somebody. So there's that kind of like, you know, everything stacked against me. Let me just, I don't know about saying let me be average, but a lot of people like that. I mean, I know in Ukraine, there's a lot of tech and developer talent, one of the, like, the best countries in the world for, you know, web development, programming. And there are a lot of startups that have come out of Ukraine. But I think it's one of those things where, like, you're still oppressed in a way because truly aren't in like a free market, free system, or a free country, because, you know, the odds are kind of manipulated and you don't have necessarily a fair playing field, which isn't necessarily the case in the US. I mean, sometimes that happens too, but in a different sense. So it's not like where the government itself is super corrupt. I'm not saying the government isn't corrupt on a state, local, federal level in the US. I mean, there's that, but it's openly and blatantly corrupt in Ukraine.
Wow, yeah. And it's unfortunate at how many countries and markets are just so overtly corrupt. And, you know, I haven't looked at it myself, but I'm sure there's a huge correlation between these nations that are so corrupt and the number of, you know, skilled workers and sort of brain drains that they get of people leaving the country because of that kind of level of corruption. And I know that that could open up a whole new conversation. But moving over to your school days, and from what I recall, did you start school and, you know, the time you started school, you barely spoke any English?
Yeah, I spoke no English. So I went to kindergarten without a word of English. I got put in a class where if you come to the U.S., you have like a special class called ESL, English Second Language.
Yeah.
We basically learn the language. And obviously, being that young, you pick up concepts and, you know, themes and knowledge really quickly. So I was surrounded every day, Monday to Friday, for the whole school day of people speaking English, people speaking. So I think it was second grade where I tested out and I was like completely fluent. So I remember, I think in kindergarten, first grade, I still had an accent. But obviously, when you learn a language before a certain age, phonetically, the way your brain is getting programmed, you don't retain that accent. Obviously, my parents, grandparents still have that accent, even though they're fluent in English. But I think that benefited me in a way, because obviously, if I don't say I'm from Ukraine or speak Ukrainian, or people don't know my last name, obviously Roman is more of an Eastern European name, you're not necessarily going to know, you know, what part of the world I'm from.
And do you think that there was a significant benefit for you that you did move at such a young age? You know, do you think that as you get older, it actually becomes more difficult to adapt to a new environment and new settings and new language because, you know, you're kind of more set in your old ways?
I think so. I think, you know, there's that thing where people say, you know, they're too old or stuck in their ways. So I was at that age, you know, first year in school. So I was kind of easily moldable in that sense. The town I moved to had actually we first went to like a Ukrainian speaking church. So there was, you know, at least 100, 150 people in that town that went to that church that spoke Ukrainian. And there were other people, actually, like Brazilians, Portuguese, Polish, so from South and Central America and all over Europe, really, in that town, moving there from those countries at that time. So they were, like, going through a similar experience to me. So it was nice, I guess, having kids, and kids not only from Ukraine, that were experiencing the same thing and were experiencing it together.
Yeah, I really love how you've said that, because something I've become more aware of, especially as I speak to more guests, is how there seems to be this natural connection between individuals and especially kids who've been through this migration experience, especially at a young age. And it brings me nicely onto a point I've been eager to ask you about, which is during your school years, you were, is it selling cards and also set up lemonade stalls and even sold sweets?
Yeah.
So, yeah, tell me about how, you know, this business mindset of yours came about, or, you know, some might even describe it as a hustler's mindset.
I mean, it was one of those things where I saw it being done and you can make a profit. And then with that profit, it was literally elementary school and middle school. And then I can do and invest that money or, you know, get more inventory. Basically, I think it was like my first kind of business lessons. And I'm so pissed, like, thinking back, you know how many Michael Jordan cards I sold back in the day? That if I had those, if they were mint and I got them graded, they would be, like, a considerable amount of money. But, yeah, like, buy wholesale candy at, like, you know, Costco or Sam's Club here, like, the, you know, the bulk shopping stores, and then go to school. Obviously, you weren't allowed to do that, so it was kind of, like, under the table at lunch or whatever, like, in my backpack, like, people know I would have it, like, you know, let me get a candy bar or whatever. And then kind of, like, the baseball cards and stuff like that, and really, like, supply and demand, whatever was popular. I remember at one point, like, the Pogs and the Slammers and whatever was kind of, like, the fad, I would jump on that and ride that wave and, you know, hustle that until the next thing. So it was, like, actually led me into really marketing what I've been doing for 13 years because, like, really understanding trends and capitalizing on the wave before it goes away and stuff like that. I think the best sell I made was, it was like Valentine's Day here, and I got like a little necklace out of one of those pinball machines. You put like 50 cents, 25 cents in, and then somebody saw it and they're like, oh, I want to give this girl this. It was like in fifth grade. I'm like, cool, $20. So I got it for like 25 cents. He gave me $20 for it. It was like one of the easiest kind of, I guess, flips, because I like doing that sometimes too, finding things and then understanding the value currently of them and then obviously flipping them for a profit also.
I mean, what is that? Is that 1,000 or?
I mean, it was.
And even 10,000% markup.
It was a good thing. I mean, even like with the things that the profit wasn't that much, I mean, a box of candy I would make probably 10, 20 bucks on and then just reinvest it into inventory. So, I mean, it taught a lot of business principles early. And I mean, I've done things like lemonade stands, all that. So like anything I can help out with or I saw an ability to profit from. And I had situations where I had kind of like employees in like elementary school. So I would set up the lemonade stand, have those people like officiate it or sit and sell the lemonade. then I would collect the funds and then I would give them their cut. And for me being like the business, I would take like my share, but not be there to work the stands. So.
See, and those are the things that the schooling curriculum just doesn't teach you.
Yeah, I mean, the value of education, certain things you have to go to school. I think some of the STEM, so like science, technology, engineering, math, medicine, like you need some kind of formal schooling for. But things like entrepreneurship or digital marketing or careers like that, I think like the real world experience surpasses that, you know, things that you learn from a book.
And do you think that mindset was inherently always in you? Like, say if you didn't move from Ukraine to the US, do you think you'd have still been like that? Or was it very much the journey you went through and having to start with so little that really kicked you into gear in that way of thinking?
Now, I think I would have, because Ukraine has one of the biggest black market economies in the world. So like under the table money, not to say like black market, like, you know, like contraband or human trafficking or like drug trafficking, just people making do and obviously selling things for cash. I think in Ukraine, like even though I was from a city called Lviv, it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's about 1 million people on the western side of Ukraine, close to the Polish border. So very historic city. It was founded by, you know, Vikings back in the day and stuff like that. But even in the cities, people had like gardens and plots of land outside of the city. So everybody would have like produce or like chickens or like kind of like a homestead that they can go. And I guess if things got bad, they can be growing all their stuff and then go to the market and, you know, hustle that. Or if they had skills like, you know, Ukrainian, like the traditional like clothing or like these embroidered kind of shirts, like, you know, every country has that, you know, traditional national clothing or whatever from back in the day. So every region of Ukraine has like a different embroidery. So it's very meticulous to do that. So people do that. So it's just like capitalizing on what your strengths are in terms of like, as a creator. I mean, we're on a podcast, you know, we're both creators creating content in this sense. Well, they're creating, you know, art, different other things. So I think I would have still have done it to a certain extent, maybe not what I did in the US or the way I went in terms of like the direction of my life, but to a certain extent, it still would have been kind of a similar path, I think.
Yes, for sure. I feel like that kind of drive does usually originate from a place within. And so you also mentioned that there were 7 of you staying in a 2-bedroom. What was that like?
Yeah, 6 other family members. So my parents, my brother, my grandparents, and my aunt. So yeah, 7 in total plus me. That was only for a while because everybody, like, so all the adults worked at one point or another. I would be in school. My brother was a baby. So he's 4 years and like 10 months younger than me. So everybody worked to a certain extent. So my father and my grandfather went to do construction, and then they went, and then when they were done, they would rotate night school to learn English and get some kind of certification. Like, obviously computers were still like in their infancy in terms of usage, but they were at some like computer science type, you know, courses at night just to get like some kind of like foot in the door. And then my aunt worked at some kind of factory where they put some kind of like computer chips together, and my grandmother and my mom would clean houses. So like whatever they could get at the time. And then in that situation, I think it was only a few months where then myself, my brother, my mom, and my dad were able to get our own place. And then my grandfather, my grandmother, and my aunt stayed at the place that we originally moved to.
And I'm really glad that you brought up your grandfather, because I know that he played a very significant role in your life. And you talk about how he worked in roofing into his 70s. Now, no job is easy working into your 70s, but especially something that physically demanding. How much do you think his, you know, attitude of work hard and do your duty without complaining, how much do you think this influenced your character?
I think a lot. I haven't spoken to my father in person since 2008. I've texted him on and off. Like, there's a history, a backstory. Like, he was present, but he was never there. There was domestic violence. You know, when my mom was pregnant with my brother, he threw her down the stairs. My brother was supposed to be stillborn. Like, you know, he was abusive to, you know, other family members, like my grandparents, my aunt physically. So he, my grandfather was like kind of like the main male role model throughout my life, and kind of that work ethic. He would work, he would go to work 7 a.m. to 7 p.m, Monday to Saturday. And then on Sunday, he would go to church at 10 a.m. and then 6 p.m. and do this all year round. And summers in New Jersey get hot and humid. So he was to the point where like the shingles and stuff have tar in them, like in terms of the roofs in New Jersey. So like it was so hot where like he had no more like arm hair or leg hair because it got singed off over time because of the tar. So it got that hot and he would be on the roof all the time. And then obviously in the winter, the roofing doesn't really happen. But even in the fall, it gets kind of cold. Sometimes it starts snowing. So he was already retired when we came over here. He was a carpenter. He worked in the furniture factory and he retired at like 55, 54. And then he came over here and then, you know, had to work another 20 years, which he did, you know, never complained, did what he had to do, took care of everyone. And, you know, I don't think I've ever heard him complain of being in pain or anything like that. Other than one time where he fell off a roof, he had to hold a gutter because the thing was falling and there was somebody underneath. So if he let go of that, he wouldn't have fallen, but the thing would have probably killed the person under him.
Wow.
It's a pretty bad fall, but thank God all that really happened, he's like messed up his arm. So he broke his wrist, like fractured his arm. But other than that, there was no complaints of anything for like all that time.
Yeah, I think that's a fair enough reason to voice your agony naturally when going through something like that, no matter what age you are. And why did he come out of retirement, do you know? Was it because he felt the need that he had to, or was it more out of a choice because maybe he just wanted to contribute his bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was out of necessity because, like, you know, you said, you know, people leaving from that part of the world and where we came, like when we came, we can only take what we can carry. And there was a limit to the amount of cash. And then the currency was collapsing too. So whatever you did have didn't transfer into much. So we basically came here with nothing.
Right.
So the more adults that worked, you know, the better it was. I mean, I'm not saying he was making this crazy money, but I just feel like in terms of him being like the head of the family, I think he saw it as, you know, kind of his job to take care of everyone else and, you know, do what he had to do to keep his family afloat.
Wow, that really is amazing. And how did these impact you? So when you moved on from school and entered the working life?
Yeah, so I guess not to complain as much or just like deal with situations a little differently. The career I ended up in wasn't the career I thought I was going to have. So it was kind of making do with any situation. I could have been like, no, like, I don't know this, I'm not going to do it. But, you know, getting into digital marketing from, I thought I was going to go in criminal justice and interning with the Secret Service before I graduated college and stuff like that. And then obviously the recession happening, and that's one reason I got into digital marketing. I think with him, it's just taking opportunity of any situation and then later on kind of running with it and thinking about other people or being mindful of how I got to the US, like what it took for my parents and grandparents to get me here. And it would just be like stupid to waste that opportunity on my part, knowing what they went through and knowing what other family members, you know, had to deal with in Ukraine back in the day. My grandfather's dad came to the U.S. for a few months, like back in the day, maybe it was the 30s, but to New York just to make some money to bring back home. A lot of people come, you know, to a lot of, you know, Western European countries on like a work visa. So basically, I don't know what the visa was like back in the 1920s, but I think he came over to the to New York, worked for like 6 months and then brought money back. But obviously he didn't stay here. So it's just one of those things where just being mindful of the sacrifices other people made. And then when an opportunity comes about, knowing that that opportunity may not present itself again and taking like full opportunity of it in the moment and doing whatever you can and putting in max effort to see it, you know, come to fruition.
Yes, I love that. I really love what you've said there. And I think there's two really important points that you touched on and that I've really sort of uncovered while investigating, you know, the immigrant mindset and these common traits between people. And the first one is that idea of adaptability. You know, when you've grown up in one place and moved to another, often quite different, you, at a young age, learn to have to adapt. And the more you get accustomed to that, the more it becomes easier for you, or the more you're able to adapt in other situations and other challenges and difficulties that you face. And the second being the idea of sacrifices that you and your family have made. So especially recognizing the sacrifices that your family have made, it almost adds that extra drive of really wanting to succeed, or at least to not want to fail. And so with that kind of extra, I know what I've had to sacrifice, I know what my family have to sacrifice, it does push you that a little bit further, I feel. And yeah, that's why I just think it's really crucial what you mentioned there.
Yeah, and I think it's mindset, because a couple years ago, we used to do Airbnb because we had a bunch of extra bedrooms. There's a couple universities in my town or close to it, like people coming and going. So we had someone come from a couple from Belarus, which is also in, you know, Eastern Europe. So like literally they came, they stayed with us like 3-4 days, and they came here to like set up like and stay kind of permanently. They had a visa or whatever. So some people that I saw complaining for like months about no job or this and that, they found a place to live. They both found jobs. They both got cell phones activated. They got like their paperwork, and they did this all in like 4 or 5 days. So basically they established somewhat of a, you know, a living situation and had a means to support themselves in a few days. And I think that's just like the mindset that you're coming from, because I mean, if you look at a lot of unicorn companies, a lot of Fortune 500s, they're either, you know, immigrants, a lot of them from Eastern Ukraine, first generation, or their parents were first generation immigrants,
right?
You know, huge companies. I feel like that mindset and coming from that environment just kind of breeds success, because you kind of refuse to take anything otherwise.
Yeah, I completely agree. And when you look at the Fortune 500 companies and you see that, what is it, almost half are immigrant CEOs. And I also read that over the last decade, the unicorn companies to emerge, I think 55% of those are immigrant founders. So, you know, there's something to be said about the fixed and growth mindset. And I've heard you talk about companies where some are just functioning and others are really striving to grow. And I really related that to individuals. So there are some who are, you know, for a better term, functioning, and those that are looking to grow. So when you look at companies, do you think there's something to be said about the type of managers that run these companies and how they almost set the company culture and management style, and that really reflects how the business ends up performing?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a mindset. I think a lot of that comes from obviously how they were raised and where they came from. Like for me personally, like I had to have a mindset shift. Like for at first when I got into like the, you know, career I'm in, it was more like corporate. So it was just like kind of chasing like a promotion, or other people controlled your destiny. And then even like you said, people just kind of like go through the motions and don't necessarily like carve their own path. So like what I say is, complacency is the death of innovation. So when you get comfortable, someone's out there is like grinding and like coming after you. So if you like take it easy, like you'll get overtaken. Just in like, you know, companies, some of the Fortune 500s, like you look 10, 20, 30 years, they don't exist on that list anymore because they got complacent. You know, they got stagnant, they didn't innovate, they didn't kind of like adapt to what they needed to adapt. And I think being an immigrant, like we, I think you briefly mentioned it earlier, you get thrown in a situation on the other side of the world and you have to adapt and figure it out. So it's just one of those things. Like, I feel like having a CEO or executive that has come out of that, you know, makes them tougher just from a mindset perspective. And that kind of grit, I think, is infectious. So I think like leadership is, you know, top down when people see a great leader. And I think it's also important to not lead on a pedestal, but yes, like lead from the same level, or just inspire, or be a motivator and kind of be in the trenches. Because if you teach people, if you show that they're important and you're not above them, they're more likely to be loyal to you and work harder for you. And, you know, you're there to see them succeed, and vice versa, they're giving back to the company and are motivated to see the company succeed as well.
Yeah, that really is so well said. And, you know, for those listening, really take note of this section and, you know, even mark it down and come back to it, because I think there's some really important points that were made. And the only other thing I really want to add to that is this idea of servant leadership, which is, you know, the philosophy that some of the best leaders are also the best servants. And when you hear some employees talk about these top CEOs that they've worked for, they'll say that, you know, the CEO would often come to them and say, how can I help you? And I think it's really powerful because it's really these leaders are putting the focus of others above their own, and it creates this much more trusted manager-employee relationship and a much longer-term success for the company. So
yeah, and it's how you treat employees across the board. So it could be, you know, an intern, it could be a janitor at your corporation. Are you treating them the same as you would treat, you know, somebody on your, you know, board of directors or in your executive? And if you are, then people are seeing that. So, you know, treating somebody that, you know, other people may look down on the same way you would, you know, show the same respect. And I think that's, I guess, your upbringing and where you come to or from as well. And, you know, employees see that as well and reflect to it. I mean, I've had some good bosses, some bad bosses, executive teams at company I was at before I kind of founded my agency as well. And, you know, employees see that and they're either turned off by it or they're motivated by certain actions. So, you know, it's just kind of the direction you take. And, you know, in that kind of role, you're transparent too. So whatever you do, people are watching, regardless if you think so or not.
Yeah, and to also mention here, of course, there are also individuals who've been through this kind of immigrant experience that don't share these characteristics, and vice versa, those who haven't, who really strongly do. But do you think that this kind of grit and determination to create and grow has to be somewhat inherent in the person to begin with? And so I guess what I'm trying to ask is, can these type of characteristics be taught to someone?
I think it could be taught to a certain extent, but not necessarily like replicated, because you can't replicate kind of like the life experiences that have molded someone. So I feel like for me personally, like my emotional IQ and my level of empathy is driven directly by my experiences, like in career wise and all the jobs I've held and everything I've done professionally and personally. And that comes from experience. So at some point, that person that is looking to acquire that skill, they're going to have to be tested in one way or another. And I don't know if they're going to be reacting to it the same way or fold a little easier when like pressure comes, because they haven't had those experiences and haven't had those experiences that build up kind of their emotional IQ. Because I feel like when you are an executive, I think it's important to be able to read people, understand people, understand signals, and really like delegate in that sense from looking in and being sympathetic to situations. Because I feel like if I was presented a situation now, I would have handled it a lot differently 10 years ago, just based on the experiences that I've had and the understanding that I've gained.
Exactly. And something that stood out to me from what I've heard you say, and in fact, I even wrote it down, was that, you know, knowledge is all well and good. You can be the smartest person, but achieving nothing if you don't have that hunger. And so I'd love to know your thoughts on how can someone help themselves find that hunger? And maybe a prerequisite question to that is that kind of burning desire and drive even meant for everyone?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's situational. I mean, and I don't knock anybody's situation or what they're trying to do, whatever is the right fit for someone's life. Someone may have the goal of, you know, being with a corporation or company and working, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years and retiring because it works for them. That's what they want to do. But if you say that to another person with a different mindset, that may be kind of crippling to them, to their creativity or what they want to do in life. So it's based on the individual themselves. And I mean, for me, I think, like I said, the complacency is the death of innovation, but that's all well and good, but you have to be able to take action. Like you could be as smart as you want, and you can have this life-changing historic idea, but if you never get it off the ground and it's only in your head and you don't do anything or take the steps to do so, it's not going to go anywhere. And somebody may even, you know, run with it or have the same idea down the line. And then you're going to sit there and regret, you know, oh, I could have did this. You know, I had the same idea. Well, you didn't act on it. You know, ideas are great, but they don't necessarily get you anywhere. The same thing. There's a lot of smart people, but they're just comfortable, you know, being told how to harness that knowledge and that wisdom, where there's people that I wouldn't say not as smart, but are more driven and have like a different drive that they'll take action. I think,
yeah,
there are also like some statistic where there's a lot of like leaders, CEOs, startup founders that weren't like straight A students. You know, they were like C students, but they take action and they're not necessarily like good in a classroom, but in the real world, they're awesome. So there's a difference between being book smart and being street smart as well. And I think having a mix of that, I think, comes into play and benefits you a lot, I think, in the business world.
Yeah, for sure. And I know through your company, Nova Zora, and also through your Digital Savage Experience podcast, you've interacted with a lot of high achievers and really driven people. In your experience with these people that you've met and spoken with, did you notice any commonalities between those who, you know, come from an immigrant background and how they put themselves forward in their personal and professional life compared maybe to those who don't come from that kind of background?
I mean, the only commonality across the board is they didn't quit regardless of what they experienced in their life. And, you know, company-wise, the companies that you see visible, a lot of them succeeded not because of like crazy innovation in their industry. They just didn't give up and they outlasted everybody else when they all dropped off. So like everybody has the opportunity, regardless of what their situation is today. If they wake up with, you know, breath in their lungs tomorrow, they can change their situation or at least take the steps to do so. So I think not quitting, because I feel like there's a lot of people that could have achieved whatever level of success they were looking to achieve, or, you know, whatever relationship they were looking to build or make a connection or get that ideal guest for their show, but they quit too early. Like they didn't have that perseverance. So having that perseverance and drive and awareness not to quit early, because I feel like majority of people don't necessarily ride something till it's almost or about to be successful.
Yeah, wow, I couldn't agree more. And for me, it really draws back to something that we touched on earlier. When someone's been through that journey of moving to another country, especially when it's permanent, then that threshold for giving up is almost so much higher. And in a lot of cases, they don't even have the option to say that they tried and failed and can just go back. And so when that becomes ingrained, I feel it transfers into so many other aspects of their life. And it really helps them to strive that extra bit further and not give up. But what I'd love to do now is dive into some of the more personal aspects of your life. So, of course, you know, we've covered some of the experiences and the journey that you've been on. But how have you seen that translate into the more personal elements of your life?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, I guess, numbing in terms of some of the stuff I've experienced. Obviously, when you get to a certain part of your life, it's inevitable that you'll have, you know, loss in terms of, you know, family or close friends and things of that nature, but also things like, you know, going through 5 miscarriages or the experience of fostering 25 children, which teaches you a lot about yourself too. So all those situations, I mean, they're tough. And I mean,
for sure,
in any situation, I think people would say life happens, but having those experiences, and not to say that they don't still affect me or, you know, they're part of you or, you know, part of the person experienced it. It just, you develop a better coping mechanism if you kind of come to terms with them and learn to cope a little bit better, so they don't necessarily negatively impact the other things or spill over to different parts of your life. So if you don't deal with like pain, grief, some kind of rage, something that, you know, is causing you a negative emotion internally, eventually, if you don't come to terms with it or find a release, whether that's, you know, running, workout, reading, you know, meeting with people, going to counseling, whatever that is, it's going to eat you up inside. So I think kind of coming to terms and accepting what it was, and, you know, it's obviously a negative experience, but learning to deal with it and then harnessing it for something good. So I feel like there's things where you can use and then have pity on yourself and then justify negative actions in your life. So let's say if your father is an alcoholic and his father was an alcoholic and, you know, your grandfather's father was an alcoholic, you have a crutch to now say, if you wanted to, well, it's generational, I'm destined to do that, like whatever, let me just accept it. or you can use it to drive you to change and then change that narrative. So you have the option to do so.
Oh, 100%. And, you know, you often can't control what happens to you, but you can control how you react to it. And so that narrative piece becomes really key in framing how you approach these challenges and situations when they come your way. And so when did your narrative form around fostering? You mentioned fostering 25 children, which is amazing. When did you take that decision or create that narrative that this was an approach that you were going to take?
Well, I mean, like I said, we experienced all those miscarriages and we thought about, you know, maybe this is a good way to possibly start a family or at least help kids in the process. So technically, like, we're classified as foster to adopt. So if we have a child and the parental rights are terminated of that child while they're in our home, we would be the first ones that the, you know, Division of Child Services would come to and ask, you know, is this a good fit? Does it make sense for you to adopt them? So, I mean, it's been tough. I think the system is broken. So, like, I try to advocate as much as I can for foster care reform and changing the system and how the kids are treated in the system and treated as individuals and not just case numbers and situations. So, I mean, each case is tough, but, like, getting into it, we didn't necessarily know what we were getting into because, you know, you go to an orientation and then you sign up for, like, the background information and the family study and the home inspection and stuff like that. And then you have in-class training for about 9-10 weeks every week. And obviously they're not trying to scare you away because they need good foster homes and good foster parents. But I feel like if they were more positioned as like a scare trait, so they tell you what will happen in certain situations and not like, you know, sunshine and rainbows, everybody is like here for you and how that, I mean, sometimes it feels like it's like you against the world with the system and, you know, advocating for the kids is kind of our number one priority. So it's tough in that sense, but it's also something that's like super grounding where you think about, you know, 2-, 3-, 4-year-olds that have experienced more in their lives than most adults. And then when you have something in your life, like you get an email you don't agree with or somebody like saying something they don't like about you or something like that, you kind of can take a step back and like, am I really going to get mad about this when, you know, this child is dealing with so-and-so? So I think being a foster parent and each child and each case really puts things in perspective and is a good kind of litmus test of like regrouping and recalibrating to what's truly important in your life.
So like you say, the system, at least as it currently is, very much favors the biological parent. Knowing this and having been through so many experiences with foster children, how did you adopt that mindset where you were still able to give all your love and care to each of the children that you fostered, knowing that there is always this chance that within the coming months, they would be taken away from you purely because of how the system has been set up?
Yeah, sometimes it's even days. I mean, the shortest placement we had was a few days. The longest was over a year. And I mean, it's more so obviously you gain different connections with children. Sometimes when a child's with you a lot longer, you have a lot more time to bond and connect. But at the end of the day, I mean, it's more so worrying care and thinking about, you know, are they okay? Are they in the same situation that they came out of? You know, are they flourishing? Or are they growing?
Yeah.
Stuff like that. And yeah, it's like going, it's setting yourself up to be hurt every time, theoretically, because from the 25 children, you know, all the cases have, you know, they've been moved to family or reunified or things of that nature, especially our first case that we had two brothers for a year. And it was positioned from day one, like, you know, this case is moving to adoption, you know, you're going to get to adopt them. And then a year later, they're reunified with their biological mom because cases in terms of direction can change overnight. And it's tough. I mean, it's kind of heartbreaking. I think I actually talked to like a therapist about it, and they're like, it's a specific kind of loss and you have to deal and cope with it differently. So there's loss and grief when you lose someone in your life, you know, because they pass away. But when you lose someone and you're not in control of it when they're alive and you know you can't see them, you can't talk to them, it's like a different grieving process. So it's tough every time, but I think being as open as possible, regardless if you know you're going to get hurt again, is key. Because I think if I was like super closed in or not being able to love or show affection in that way, I would probably stop doing it because I feel like the kids deserve that from the situations they're coming from. And for me, I guess as an adult, I think it's a little easier for me to take that kind of like, you know, pain or whatever to see these kids possibly get better and start flourishing and heal from what they experienced.
Yeah, and that's what I love about your story and your character development is just how selfless and mature your way of thinking is in this, and not even just in this area. And I feel like when someone has been through so many, you know, almost life-changing experiences, it really does help to evolve that strength in character. So I love hearing about it. And so looking forward, do you see that number of 25 increasing? What's the plans for the future?
I don't know about increasing. I mean, the most kids we've had at once is 6. It's crazy. Oh, but also, it's one of those things, you don't know what you're capable of until you do it. So if you asked me 3 years ago, would you be a foster parent? You see yourself, you're going to be a foster parent. I'm probably like laughing, saying like, no, that's crazy. Just that alone. And then if you ask me, you know, 2.5 years, you'll have 25 kids come through your home. I'd be like, what are you talking about? That makes no sense. But I feel like there's initial fear for anything you do, like the fear of the unknown. Will I succeed? Is it going to fail? And I think that's like natural human nature to want to be in a comfort state. So like you're in a habit, you don't want to rock the boat. And the first step is getting out of your own mind and going into that position or area of uncertainty. And then majority of the time in my life when I've stepped out of that, you know, good things have happened, you know, learning experiences, growth, opportunities professionally and personally. So there is always that. I mean, if anyone wants to foster, I don't dissuade them, but just understanding the situation. But it's definitely helped me grow as a person. And one of those things that if I can go back and the cases and the things that I've experienced would have played out the same exact way, I would have still probably did it, because it adds, I guess, to my character, who I am, how I handle relationships, how I treat people within the business world, within the personal world, and just like gives me a different layer of perspective.
Yeah, that's amazing. And it's actually something that I was meaning to ask you about, that when you first started fostering, did you ever envision that years ahead it would be anything like the number that it turned out to be? And what's really admirable is that you are able to go through this experience so many times and bring a new child into your life and still give them all your love, care, and attention, even given what you'd been through. And so it's truly admirable, and I really respect you for that.
Yeah, there's no like number set, but hopefully one of the children we have now, we get to adopt based on how their case is going and how, like, what's going on with that. And other than that, it's just one of those things. We have like one of the things that's like super important to me in my house. Like if my house, you know, burned down, and obviously my dogs are, you know, my wife and the kids weren't in the house, that I would probably take out of the house first. We have a canvas, and each child that was in our home, we have their handprint. So we take their handprint. So it has their name and when, from what date they were in our home, and then when they left. So that's like something that like I always look at and think about the kids, where they're at and stuff like that. So it's one of those things where I think that I'll carry on and try to preserve, and wherever I live, have that in my home, and hopefully like pass on at some point to, you know, someone.
Yeah, I really like what you said about the handprints on the canvas. And I feel I can really resonate to that, because, you know, the basis of this podcast is to provide a medium for people to share their stories, and so their experiences and lessons they've learned can live on to inspire for the generations ahead. And so I love that idea of legacy building. And I feel, you know, with the canvas, each handprint symbolizes a special relationship and set of experiences that you have with each child. And like you say, you know, when you hopefully pass that on with the canvas, you'll pass on those messages and those inspirations, and so those can live on forever as well. So I love that. And you know, there's, you also mentioned about your house burning down, and there's still so many layers to your life story that we haven't even covered, but you talk about it in your podcast. So for anyone listening, I highly recommend checking out some of these episodes, because you get to learn so much about your story, and it's amazing that you've decided to share that with the world. And so just before we round off, I'd love to know, what are you working on now, and what are your plans for the future?
I mean, professionally, I still have a digital marketing agency, Nova Zora Digital. I still have my show, The Digital Savage Experience, which I have 100 episodes in queue. I have up to like episode 315 recorded at this point. So I've interviewed about 300 people at this point in like the last year and a half, 2 years when I switched over to an interview format. So still kind of telling people stories, because like you just mentioned, I didn't think my story was of any significance at all, or like my stuff wasn't worth sharing. And then about 2 years ago, I started going and doing interviews on other shows to tell my story and see like how it reacts. Maybe I can help people. And I feel like if you think you can touch or, you know, save one life out there and you do it, like it's all worth it. And if someone isn't expressing what you have, like you're looking for support or help with something or a specific topic, and that voice isn't there, become that voice. Because,
love that.
You know, a lot of people don't want to share about, you know, going through miscarriages and infertility or even what they experience in terms of a foster parent. But I saw from the male perspective, there weren't a lot of or at all people talking about it in terms of their experiences or how they're going through it. And I felt like, I know I'm not the only one that has experienced it, so let me just become the voice to, you know, connect people and maybe give some kind of inspiration. So I think you really don't know how inspirational your story is, because a lot of the time human nature, you devalue, you know, your experiences, or like nobody wants to hear this, like I'm just average, so on and so forth. But you'd be surprised how many people you can touch and impact out there. And then obviously the other thing, we met on Clubhouse. So out of Clubhouse, my second podcast started, and the website for that, Real Talk Podcasting. So doing that with some interesting kind of collaborations and interviews coming up within the industry, you know, other things obviously coming out, Twitter Spaces, Fireside Chat. So really kind of giving back in the podcast space from what I've learned in digital marketing for 13 years to help people avoid some of the stuff that I've experienced, because I feel like if Clubhouse was around, it's like a fast track. Like if you want to take the recommendations that you're given and do something with them, you can really accelerate what you're trying to do. I think, you know, Rial and Andrews and some of the rooms that we're in, we gave him a bunch of advice and he literally takes it that day and does it. And he's seen, you know, exponential growth with the show and, you know, how he treats his show, because he's taking action. There's a lot of people that I know that ask a question and they're not going to do anything with it, because I feel like the question is asked with self-doubt. So regardless of what answer they're given, you know, they're still going to be in that state of, you know, being stagnant. So I feel like a lot of stuff is that mindset, getting out of your own head and really taking opportunity of today.
Yeah, it's brilliant what you said there. And something that I've really grown to learn is with podcasting, it really is a two-way benefit. So like you say, through the listeners really get inspiration from some of the podcasts they listen to and the stories that are shared on there. But equally as much for the host, it really provides them a platform to be able to talk about their vulnerabilities, maybe where they're not able to do that with the people around them, either because they feel they'll get judged or they just don't feel comfortable with people that already know them so well. Whereas through this podcast platform, you're able to outreach to people who really are looking to hear these kind of stories, and it allows you to get that stuff off your chest. And so that's something I've really learned, is it's amazing about podcasting in general.
Yeah, there's no gatekeepers either. So with kind of some traditional media avenues you may have to go through, like on TV, if your programming doesn't match the station or things of that nature, you can't air it or get that idea out. So, and I've seen, obviously, I feel like audio is a superior delivery mechanism of content. It's the only thing that you can really somewhat multitask. So you can reach people while they're doing and living their lives. Like, you know, I'm on the go, I'm driving kids to daycare, I'm working and still listening in. I feel like that's there. And I feel like it's definitely helped me grow, like in communication, having more confidence, speaking in front of people.
Yeah.
Networking, I think it's added a lot of layers and has been super beneficial. And then I have a personal connection with the interview process, because I switched over to the interview format in terms of the Digital Savage Experience podcast a month after my grandfather passed away. So I feel like I did that because I wanted to like shut that silence off and overthinking and just like overprocessing in my mind, because I mean, before even COVID, I've been remote in terms of kind of my work structure for about 5-6 years. So when I started interviewing people, one, you know, networking and just kind of like getting my mind off it, but two, learning that people have experienced similar things, loss, grief, things in their life mm-hmm. that some are experiencing now and others experienced and how they've coped with it. So indirectly, it was like a healer or like part of the grieving process that helped me kind of come to terms with that loss. So I have that personal connection with my show now.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, what you're doing now with Real Talk Podcasting, and part of what you guys are doing is really inspiring other podcasters and aspiring them with the knowledge that they need. And not just around marketing and branding and technical support, but even just giving them the courage to either grow or start their podcast, because you guys have seen what it's done for you and you're selflessly giving that back now. And so I really applaud that. And so just before we move on to that final five, is there anything else you'd like to share either around your own story or experiences or specific lessons that you think are worth mentioning?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think the biggest takeaway for me in anything is just taking action. Just like meeting two people on a new social media platform 6 weeks ago, trying to grow, not even wanting to, but creating more of a community by just giving back as much value as possible and not asking anything in return, then just deciding to start a podcast and a corresponding website in terms of like giving value and adding knowledge and launching that in a week and a half. It just, you have the opportunity to do anything and just take action.
Yeah, it's a really powerful point that you've made. And being someone who's tuned into the community that you guys have created on Clubhouse and been a beneficiary of so much knowledge that I've gained off you guys, and knowing it's come from a selfless place where you guys have given up your time to help people with their questions, I'm really thankful, and I'm sure on behalf of the others that they are too. And so to move on to the final five, if you're ready, we'll kick that off.
Yep, I'm good.
Okay, so question number one, which skill of yours do you think has been developed the most through your immigrant experience?
I think being able to read people and actually consume and not like profile in a bad way, but really understand who somebody is before like opening my mouth. So like, I think I do a good job of that when I'm trying to answer a question, like getting all the facts first. And that's made from where, you know, I came from and where I came to, because where I came to, there were people from all walks of life, you know, all over the world. The way they, you know, dealt with things were different. The way they thought in terms of mindset were different. So I think it molded me so I can but be as productive as possible in terms of communication from people from different parts of the world.
Yeah, I love that. That is a great answer. And question number two, and it's bending the rules slightly because it's two questions rolled into one, but what would you say to a 20-year-old version of yourself, but also what do you think a 20-year-old version of you would say to you now?
A 20-year-old version would say to me now, I think they would just be a little still lost or like telling me something or being too confident in themselves when they shouldn't necessarily be, because I feel like when you're getting into something or a career or whatever, you're young, you feel like you know everything. And then when you reach a certain level of success or, you know, you have a skill set that's mastered in an industry, you get that imposter syndrome. So there's like the two traits. Like if I was speaking to a younger self, I would say maybe even bypass college and get into digital marketing sooner and take advantage of the landscape, because then it was like the Wild West in terms of like what you were able to achieve and the amount of money you were able to make online. So just taking advantage of that and being more, I guess, meticulous and taking every opportunity, because, you know, I feel like at 20, you want to hang out, you want to do this, you want to do that, and, you know, just stay on course and have focus.
Yeah, for sure. On that point around stay on course and have focus, I mean, we talked about it earlier in the episode. It's quite a common thing seen amongst so many successful people, but, you know, it's often difficult to remain consistent with. And I feel what's happened over the last year, it has given that avenue to make it a bit easier for people by eliminating so many distractions that were normally there. I guess it will be interesting to see whether it becomes more consistent in the long term when things start to go back to normal. But yeah, moving on to question three. And who has been the most interesting, or let me rephrase that, to the most valuable guest that you've had on your show?
Guest on my show?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the most interesting stories, I guess, like redemption would be, I guess, episode 164. So one of the founding members of the Medellin drug cartel, just the fact that he came from a clean cut life. He like never drank, never did drugs, and worked for the Federal Reserve at a young age, and then had access and that opportunity. And then a side job presented itself where he inadvertently was doing the books for some drug dealers in Miami. And then his access to like the Federal Reserve and stuff ended up, you know, him being, you know, one of like the instrumental people in that organization. And just listening about, like, you don't have to come from a bad part in life to get kind of seduced by money and power, but then finding your way back to something, you know, finding God, finding redemption, and then doing something and making amends for the decisions that you made. And it was interesting because, like, when I did it, all those shows like Narcos on Netflix and stuff were on, and it was just interesting, like, following the story. And what he experienced was like basically a movie, and it was just one of those interviews where also I feel like good content and good audio add to like a right mix for, you know, a perfect experience for a podcast listener. That guest had issues with audio. I got it as best as possible, but it was still one of the most listened to and shared episodes because the content was so good. So
good. That's amazing. And episode 164, you said?
Yep.
Great. So if anyone's interested to hear that, that is episode 164 of the Digital Savage Experience podcast. And I know this is a quick fire final five, but just an add-on question to that one. How did you manage to find this guy?
He actually found me in a Facebook group, and his wife does his bookings. And the same week, he did Vlad TV, which has a lot of like criminal people and rappers and stuff. Usually their videos get a few million. He did that interview the same week, and he did Concrete, which I think Tyler, in one of the rooms, if you've seen him, I think he's a producer for that show.
Okay.
That show usually interviews a lot of like, you know, criminal world elements and other people. And with the amount of shows he was getting the same week, I was kind of like honored that he was, you know, able to come on and share his story. And because he resonated with me being an immigrant, actually, because he was from Cuba originally, that immigrant journey. So there was that initial connection. So that's one reason he wanted to come on as well.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's a really great story. There's so much more I'd want to ask, but let's stick to the principles. And so moving on to question four, what message would you have for the younger generation who is still trying to discover their own hunger or passion?
I would just say, like, regardless of what people tell you, just try things as soon as possible. Learn if it's something that you enjoy, and like fail fast and be self-aware to recognize if it's a strength or weakness. So if it's something you're really good at and you develop it and you figure it out, have enough self-awareness to see that it may be a weakness in yourself or a strength in yourself. And obviously the younger you are, usually the less stuff you have in terms of responsibility. So you have that opportunity to, you know, take 2 months and learn so-and-so and then see if you can get these clients or travel. Well, right now it's a little difficult, but travel to this country and see if you can pursue this. So getting all that, and obviously it's going to give you a different worldview, different experiences, and mold you. And you're going to carry over all those kind of things you learned into whatever the endeavor you decide to do in terms of, you know, your pursuit of passion or, you know, your professional pursuits.
Yeah, you dropped some real gems there, and it's definitely one to go back and hear again and even jot down, especially what you said around fail fast, pick yourself up and move on. Even though the question was aimed at the younger generation, that really is something that applies to everyone at every stage. And the quicker that you're able to implement that kind of approach and mindset, it's going to benefit in so many areas of people's lives. So it's excellent. And finally, question five. You know, we love legacy. I love legacy. And if there's one line that you would want the future generations to remember about you, what would that one line be?
That I guess I was selfless and gave more than, you know, I expected in return. I feel like when I turned 30, I switched over to more of a a heart-led entrepreneur mindset to leave a legacy. So just impacting as many people in a positive manner, whether it's, you know, from personal or professional, if I can be there, if somebody's going through something, if I can give somebody some pointers of experiences I went through in podcasting or learn from my failures or anything in digital marketing or anything from my story, just to do so and help them. Because I feel like if you impact someone in that way, you touch them and then they can impact somebody else, and you kind of carry that legacy in that, you know, that good work basically.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about how much the work you've done has inspired so many people and changed so many children's lives. And so I really have no doubt that this work that you've done and what you're looking to inspire people with will carry on years into the future. So my utmost respect to everything, and I really thank you for sharing everything that you have with me today. And so what I do finish with is one bonus question for everyone, which is, if you could describe your immigrant journey or your life journey in 6 words, what would it be?
Oh, that's a good question. I think growth. Just any words, or it has to be like a sentence, like a coherent sentence?
Yeah, so I kind of leave it open. It was originally inspired by something called the 6 Words Memoirs. And so if it can be a sentence, then great. But, you know, if not, then 6 individual words is fine as well.
I mean, I guess learning and adapting and not forgetting who you are.
Yeah, great. Love that. That's so good. Thanks for sharing that. And thank you for everything that you shared today. It's been really eye-opening for me. So I hope it's been the same for the listeners. And I know there's so much more depth to your story that we didn't even get to cover, but I still learned so much. And so I appreciate you taking the time to share all that with me. And, you know, everything that you guys have done at Real Talk Podcasting that's really helped me, I appreciate all of that. And I look forward to connecting more and growing alongside all of you.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no problem. And thanks again, and speak soon. And that's going to do it for the episode. I really hope you were able to take something valuable away from the conversation, not just from Roman's life journey, but the countless gems of wisdom that he shared throughout. I hope by now you've subscribed, but if this is your first time here, then make sure you do, because there's a new guest episode for you every Tuesday, so you won't want to miss it. Don't forget to share any key messages or quotes from today's conversation on Instagram and tag the Journey Onwards podcast too. If you are inspired by it, then your share may just do the same for someone else as well. Don't hesitate to reach out to me or Roman on anything you'd like to discuss. Our contact info will be in the show notes. As always, I appreciate you being here, and until next time, keep adding greatness to your own journey.